I want to raise up for reflection and your attention and prayer. Perhaps I was at the Islamic Society of Central Jersey last night taking part in a panel, a town hall panel. It was amazing. Hundreds of people, very engaged. And learned that the night before last in Bellevue, Washington, a mosque was burned. So I raise that to your attention. On my Facebook page is a GoFundMe, or you know, some kind of, if you want to help fund the rebuilding of that mosque, and it will go out in the weekly email in case. And I know not all of us can, but this is what is happening. And our thoughts and prayers also go out to Ken Kohler, who had surgery this past week and should be home recovering soon, if not already. So today we're going to try something a little bit different, a little bit further into the 21st century. We're going to live Facebook this sermon. So thank you to Ryan, who's going to do it. The sermon is an abbreviated form of the sermon I wrote that won the 2016 UU History Convocation Sermon Prize, and you all were kind enough to support me as I went to Minneapolis and delivered that at the end of October. So this is called Getting Free Together, Eliminating the Ministry of Joshua Young, It Still Preaches Today. So I ask you to imagine the most notorious train cargo of its time, the body of a man executed for treason. Imagine half of the populace is simmering with vengeance, and the other half, and perhaps not even that many, grieving the loss of a hero whose passion for a righteous heaven on earth had inflamed their own. And now he had failed in his tragic, violent mission to free the slaves. Imagine decoy boxes that look like coffins but don't contain the body. Imagine careful attention to routes, even in the north, for even there this man has enemies. Imagine making the slow journey from Charlestown, Virginia, to North Elba, New York, in the uppermost corner, almost to Canada. Can we turn this down a little bit? There's reverb. Now imagine that you are an admirer of that man who sought to free the slaves by any means possible, and that you too would have done so if within your own realm. Imagine that you are in Burlington, Vermont, and the train has just passed to the south of you, the train carrying his body, and you just might be able to attend the funeral of this martyr if you leave now. Imagine with you a fierce friend and a long horse ride. Imagine a stormy night. That Lake Champlain is between you and your destination, not to mention a ferryman who refuses you passage because of why you are going. Imagine that you are the Reverend Joshua Young. So Unitarians and Universalists have a mixed record on the abolition of slavery. We moderns have a tendency to claim our affiliation with those religious abolitionist ancestors who really fought against slavery, and keep in the dusty corners those who advocated only gradualism or kept silent, some of whom profited from the cotton economy just as much as those plantation owners in the South. Among those who supported the swift elimination of the institution of slavery, there were fringe elements. The ultimate embodiment of this was John Brown, not a Unitarian, but materially supported and lauded by many in our ranks, including Thoreau and a group of wealthy Unitarian men called the Secret Six. John Brown is, by all accounts, a controversial figure. Even now, 157 years after his raid on Harper's Ferry, people have strong feelings about what he did, and not only there in Harper's Ferry, but about his earlier time in Kansas when he and his followers, fighting against the establishment in that state, led raids and killed, and then denied the extent of his role in it. Brown's attempt to foment a slave rebellion in Harper's Ferry is considered by many at best misguided and at worst cold-blooded murder. It does not help that the first person to die in his ill-fated effort was a free black man named Hayward Shepherd. But this sermon is not intended to persuade you one way or another about Brown, but to shed light on the man who buried him with honor and dignity, providing pastoral solace to his grieving family. Reverend Joshua Brown Young's small part in the John Brown narrative is not widely known. He's not on Wikipedia, not yet. And he's not even on our own Dictionary of Unitarian and Universalist Biography, though on my study leave this summer that will change. His name is not in the go-to book on the topic of those Unitarians who financially supported John Brown's quixotic mission. But his story can be found in records about the Underground Railroad and in primary texts pieced together from the late 19th century, and in the troves of lay historians connected to the two congregations he served, three of whom I want to thank now, Elizabeth Curtis in Burlington, Vermont, Melinda Green, and Steve Byrne in Groton, Massachusetts. The basic facts of his life are these. He was born in 1823. He graduated from what we now call Harvard Divinity School in 1848, and a year later married Mary Plimpton. He took his first pastorate in Boston in a church that no longer exists, and there he and Mary co-conducted on the Underground Railroad. In 1852, Reverend Young was called to be minister in Burlington, Vermont, and the Youngs continued their Underground Railroad activity there, though at a more subdued level, and there were others in that town who were much more directly involved. Burlington had become an important location on the path to freedom, as it had become essential to move once enslaved African Americans up to Canada, since the North was no longer safe. No longer safe because of the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, signed into law by Unitarian President Millard Fillmore. So this lack of safety was proved on so many occasions by the rendition of African Americans who had escaped South, had come North, had set up life, but were returned, including Anthony Burns. And you may know his name. His story is relatively well told. Anthony Burns was an escaped slave from Virginia who had been living in Boston since March of 1854, but complying with that fugitive slave law, authorities in Boston arrested Burns on May 24th. 2 days later, the members of Tremont Temple, which is a black church in downtown Boston, it's still there. I used to walk past it every day when I worked in Boston. Members of the Boston Vigilance Committee, of which several Unitarian ministers were a part, and a crowd that swelled to 2,000 unsuccessfully attempted to free Burns from jail. But in that melee, a deputy was stabbed and killed. The courts decided that Burns should be returned to his rightful slaveholder, and on June 2nd, with 50,000 people lining the streets, and I am hoping they lined the streets in disgust, Burns was led in shackles to the ship that returned him to captivity. It just so happened that Young and nearly every other Unitarian minister in the region was in Boston for professional meetings and witnessed this unjust act of rendition. Records show that many Unitarian ministers went back to their congregations and alerted them that following Sunday to what had just transpired. With his long travels back to Burlington, of course, for us now, we think that's a short trip, but if you don't have a car, it's long. Young was not preaching that first Sunday. So his fiery sermon came the following week. And in it, he preached that the fugitive slave law was, quote, wicked and infamous, a dark deed of sin, an act of treachery, and that disobedience to this human-made law was obedience. He preached these words as well. I have come back to fulfill a vow I then and there laid upon my soul to plead the cause of the slave, the cause of human rights and liberty with renewed zeal, to give whatever of talent God has bestowed on me and whatever of influence I am permitted to exert to the agitation and discussion of this evil, wrong, crime against man, sin against God, American slavery. As a side note, I want to let you know, in case you don't, just to close a loop within the larger story, that Anthony Burns' freedom was purchased by the 12th Baptist Church of Boston, a different black church, for $1,300, and within a year he was back in Boston. As far as I can tell from the historical record, there is nothing that tells us that Unitarians were involved in pursuing his freedom at that point. But let me get back to Joshua Young, and I'm going to ask us to fast forward 5 years to 1859. That Young ended up officiating at the funeral of John Brown contains both elements of fate and serendipity. Like much of the nation, Young's attention was drawn to the violent drama that took place in Harper's Ferry in the middle of October, when John Brown and his band of raiders attempted to foment the slave revolt and to bring an end to slavery. And many of Brown's co-conspirators, including two of his sons, were killed in that attack. There were those who were captured alive, and Brown was one of them, and they were brought to trial and sentenced to death. And once Brown was executed, his body was transported to the small community of North Elba, New York, where the Brown family had a farm. It's actually a farm that had once been a utopian African-American community that had been funded by a Unitarian named Garrett Smith. Joshua Young, racing against time, traveling through that dark and stormy night that I told you about before, arrived 4 hours before the funeral's appointed time and found himself the only clergy among those assembled. There had been invitations, but no one had accepted. So abolitionist Wendell Phillips enlisted Reverend Young on the spot to conduct the funeral. Phillips did the eulogy. Young offered a prayer and benediction under the shadow of the large boulder that to this day marks the gravesite. Word of the funeral spread quickly, including to Burlington, because a newspaper published a transcript of Young's words, including those spoken directly to the widow to assuage her grief. Reverend Young quoted 2 Timothy chapter 4, saying that Brown had fought the good fight, elevating the mad abolitionist as martyr equal to Saint Paul. This did not play well back home. Numerous prominent families in his congregation took great umbrage. 6 left immediately, and others left at a slower pace. Others, according to Jung's numerous memoir-like accounts, practiced social ostracism against him and his wife. Jung felt he had no choice but to resign. Some 40 years later, Jung wrote a stinging assessment of the reception he received from the congregation he had served for nearly a decade, noting that he made no apology for his sympathy with a felon, nor bringing solace to that felon's family in distress. Here are his words from the letter of resignation in Burlington, just a few years after burying Brown. "I rejoice that no graver charge is made against me than that I pushed the principle of general justice and benevolence too far, further than cautious policy would warrant, and further than the feelings of some would go along with me. In every accident which may happen through life, in pain and sorrow, in depression, in distress, I will call this to mind, this accusation to mind, and be comforted." Generally described as a gentle pastor, in this particular regard, Jung was firm and unrepentant in his role assisting the John Brown funeral, even till his dying days. Jung went on to serve other Unitarian churches, all in Massachusetts, one in Hingham, one in Fall River, and then finally, in December 1875, he arrived at what would be his final pastorate, the then sleepy town of Groton, which I served as intern minister until June of last year. And it was towards the end of his long tenure there, he served 29 years. Joshua Jung had another opportunity to say words of honor, solace, and witness in North Elba. 40 years after Brown was buried beneath that giant boulder in 1899, the bodies of the raiders at Harper's Ferry were located and disinterred. The locations had been unmarked graves. They had either been lost or kept secret to protect them from vandals. But these bodies were transported north and buried with respect next to Brown. 5 years later, in 1904, Joshua Jung died and is buried at Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts. As Unitarian Universalists, our faith comes from six sources, the second of which is words and deeds of prophetic women and men which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Words and deeds from over 160 years ago are aptly termed prophetic when they still speak to us, still hearken to us to pursue justice, when they still preach to our hearts. In 1854, Jung preached these words: "To plead the cause of the slave is to plead our own cause, to vindicate your claim and mine to the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." This is not condescension, and this is not even Christian charity, though Jung understood his abolitionist stance as writ by God and an enactment of his faith. Those words, that is what modern Unitarian Universalists call collective liberation, a notion expressed in countless liberation movements over the centuries, uttered, enacted, embodied right now by those on the cutting edge of continued efforts towards racial justice and liberation in all forms of cultural oppression. It is, when it comes right down to it, our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, or, as Dr. King said it much, much more eloquently, all people are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. Dr. King speaks still. The deeds of Reverend Joshua Young and their consequences still speak to us, both to inspire and to act as warning. That Young's ministry in Burlington was brought to a close likely because of his perceived improper, extreme stance directly related to racial justice in his time speaks now to us in how our congregations across the nation support or censor religious leaders for speaking out in support of Black Lives Matters, for risking the perception of being anti-police when in fact such prophetic witness is anti-police brutality. Or when ministers preach the social gospel, bringing ethics and morality to the pulpit, while some express concern that it's too political of a ministry. He inspires us and warns us. Of course, the struggle for racial justice dwells not in history alone, but is alive right now. For those of us who wonder what we might have done in the civil rights era as if it was a long time ago, we need not wonder about the past. We must reflect on what we are doing now. The new Jim Crow is alive and well and robust in our criminal justice system. It is about how our nation now, how systematic racism is breaking hearts metaphorically and bodies literally. It is about police brutality that is visited disproportionately on people of color. It is about the school-to-prison pipeline. Too many African-American people, especially young men, but more and more young women, experiencing discrimination, violence in our country. It is how white supremacy does not look like what it looked like in the 19th century, but is still very much alive and thriving and requires our urgent and persistent attention, not just showing up for the big public events or hanging banners, although that would be grand, but for the long haul that involves relationship building and behind-the-scenes engagement. Reverend Joshua Young shared his prophetic vision while calling on his white congregation to see their own freedom bound up in the yet-to-be freedom of African-American citizens, or not-yet citizens. He said, "To plead the cause of the slave is to plead our own cause." And he spoke in idioms and a social reality of his time. So, with humility in my heart and not nearly so eloquently, let me update his prophetic words to our modern circumstance. We affirm that all lives matter through the declaration that Black lives matter, knowing as we do, all liberation is bound up together. May we ever work to get free together. Amen.